Well, it's great to be here, and it's great that we could have a workshop today on bioenergy here today. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the work that Tom and myself have been doing up in the mountains of North Carolina. Most of us who've been dealing with bioenergy for several years have probably seen this this map before, but I think it's a good map just telling you the diversity of feedstocks that could be used throughout the country for bioenergy, whether it's for ethanol or whether it's for co-firing with the coal plants. One of the things that I sort of love about this map is that when you start looking at the south, the energy grasses seem to be more prominent and have a lot to offer us. So we have a lot of a mosaic of feedstocks that could be used for bioenergy. And one thing that they have in common, I guess, is they've always been bred for something else, or they've been wild types. They've really never been bred for the bioenergy area. And that, as plant breeders, that gives us a lot to work with, and that gives us a great starting point and a lot of fun to have as we go forward. So, as I was mentioning, in the south here, the perennial grasses seem to be really predominant, and there's a lot of grasses that we can work with. There's over 10,000 species of grasses worldwide. They're found throughout the world, and they cover about 20% of the land mass throughout the world. So that's a huge resource for us to work with. Most of them are C4 photosynthetic pathways, and meaning they can grow pretty well. They're drought and fire tolerant. While they may be drought tolerant, a lot of them require water, and they grow bigger when they grow have a lot of water. And interestingly, and as breeders, a lot of the grasses are homologous, genetically homologous, meaning that there's a lot of similarity between the different species and genera, which gives us a lot of ability to transfer information. These grasses require a few chemical inputs. They can recycle nutrients very well. They have few natural pests. However, as we sort of plant these a little bit more, and as we get more monocultures of these, I think we're going to find that there may be some more pests that come around. And we all are interested in these being grown on marginal lands. We don't want to compete with the food crops. So this is a great group of plants that we can grow on marginal lands. And they could have some other benefits, such as increased carbon sequestration. So they have a sort of a negative carbon input for most of them. So this is a little bit of a complicated figure here, but I want to just point out that there is several groups of grasses within the Saccharinae tribe that have particular interest to us. The saccharum are down here in the south. They are really big plants and have a lot of biomass. However, when we get further north into the U.S., we have a bit more cold issues. So, trying to find something a little bit more cold tolerant is important. So, we have a group of plants called the Rhipidium section, which include the Erianthus group of plants, Saccharum Arundinaceum, Saccharum Ravenna. And then we have Miscanthus, and Miscanthus seems to be fairly cold hardy up to zone 4, even into Canada. So we embarked on a study, started looking at these grasses, and this was a study that we started in 2008 that we just did some trials of different perennial grasses. We can see, I'm sure they've got the arrow there. We have Arundo, we have Miscanthus gracilimus, some Saccharum ravenna, and we have at the back here some Miscanthus giganteus. And that was sort of our starting point to get an idea of what perennial grasses were adaptable for North Carolina. And Miscanthus came out very, very competitive and stood out. So Miscanthus contains about 14 species native to Southeast Asia, and they have very high light absorption rates and have good water efficiencies, recycling nitrogen. And while they are drought tolerant and can be grown in limited water, they grow better when we give them in higher rainfall areas. So we looked at, in this study, we had two plants here, Miscanthus giganeus and Miscanthus sinensis. And Miscanthus giganeus is the standard Miscanthus. Since when I refer to Miscanthus giganeus, I'm going to be referring to the work that we did with the Illinois clone. This is a standard throughout the US. And when we compare it to Gracilomus in our trials, we found that the Gracilomus, which is an ornamental plant, had a higher biomass than the Miscanthus giganeus, although it was a little bit more diminutive. So we thought this may be attributed to the culm density within the Miscanthus gracilomus. So that was sort of one of our attributes of trying to breed this culm density into our Miscanthus. Also, gracilomus is a lot more cold hardy than some of the giganeus. So while the giganeus is a great plant and we needed to use that germplasm, but we all know Miscanthus giganeus is a triploid, an interspecific triploid that is sterile. So we embarked on a process of trying to induce fertility into it by using chromosome doubling. We use a rhizolin and we were able to achieve hexaploids from our procedures here. We took these hexaploids back into the greenhouse and grew them up. And the first thing we did was check male fertility. You can see here that Miscanthus sinensis, as our standard, has a pollen viability. This is with acetocarmine staining of 77%. And Miscanthus giganeus, acetocarmine overestimates viability, has a 34.7%. But the giganeus, when we got the hexaploid, we increased the fertility to 88%. So we're pretty sure that it was fertile. We then proceeded with looking at the female fertility and conducting crosses. And we obtained a lot of seed. And we had to go in and do some embryo rescue and germinate these in tissue culture. And we were able to achieve a small number of plants that were hybrids. And we checked the hybridity using flow cytometry. We were able to obtain about six plants from our crosses with our hexaploid giganteus and our diploid gracilomus. So these were tetraploids. These tetraploids, you can see up in the top corner here, were quite diminutive compared to the giganteus that we started off with. But we could see even at this stage there was a little bit more density in the culms. And just to show you that the cytometry, we can see the 4X, 6X, 2X, and 4X peaks to confirm they were tetraploids. We then obtained some new germplasm from China, Miscanthus luteria riparis, which in some literature is a subspecies of Miscanthus saccharophorus, which is one of the original parents of Miscanthus giganeus. And we were able to take our tetraploids and look at crossing them back with the luteria riparis. You see, the luteria riparis is quite a large plant from the natural stands in China. So the procedures we used is we cross it using our paper bags in our greenhouse. This is not our Miscanthus, this is just a demonstration of some of the other crosses or how we conducted them. since they were triploids, the seed started aborting. We didn't have much endosperm. We used embryo rescue techniques to recover the embryos and had a germinating plant. I spend most of my Decembers doing this in the lab, and I've probably gone a lot greyer from doing this over the years. We were able to take these back into the greenhouse, and we established some field plots and been able to start taking some data on them. So these are plants that are probably 3 years old now from our first set of crosses. And when we look at the height, we can see this Miscanthus giganteus here. This is the Illinois clone. And incomparable, some of our clones and hybrids are a fairly similar height. How when we came attaining yields on these single plant bases, we found that our hybrids had up to 1.8 times more yield than our standard Miscanthus giganteus, and which is quite interesting. And we've got several clones there that were way above the Miscanthus giganteus that's out there in the that's used at the moment. And we sort of attributed that to the increase in comb density. So it's pretty hard to see in this photo, but we can see that they've got the on the right there, the Miscanthus giganteus Illinois clone, and the new hybrids that we've developed. And the comb density is between about 1.3 to 2 times more per square meter than the Illinois Miscanthus giganteus. So we've really increased that density of combs. And this is sort of the field plot. We've taken these individual plants, we've propagated them, and we've established replicated field plots of three replications each of 54 plants to get more robust data on yield. As we're progressing with that, we're increasing our germplasms. We're using increasing our tetraploid lines. Again, this is the tetraploid lines compared to the Miscanthus giganteus that's in the market. We've been able to identify tetraploid lines that have increased yield that we'll start incorporating into our breeding programs. And of course, we're going to have to assess the fertility of these before we release any. And I'd like to thank our sponsors and the folks that have helped us here.
We might have time for one question.
First, do we have an in vitro system for Miscanthus regeneration? Yes, we have a somatic embryogenic system that we use regularly. We use that for chromosome doubling, and we have a pretty robust propagation methods for production or getting into our field plots. Yours, in vitro propagation. Okay. Your second question?
How do you plant it in
the
field?
Okay. No, we plant. The question was, how do we plant in the field? We plant in the field using plugs that we initiate in tissue culture. I'm not sure if this is economically viable at this stage, but it is the way that we do it for our research plots. I think there's some research needs to be done on how we can mechanicize this for the industry. After how many years do we get our first economical yield? With our new hybrids, they're getting very good growth on them. We were able to attain measurable yields in the first year compared to the Illinois clone. I'm not sure how that'll go over the long term. That needs some more trialing. But definitely by the second year, we are getting very high comparable yields on the new clones, and that's how we've taken it so far.
So in the interest of time, we probably need to move on, but hopefully we'll have a little bit of time at the end for additional questions. So thank you very much, Darren. Looks like you're making great progress.